By almost every conceivable economic metric, the 1980s were worse than today. Life expectancy, human development, median incomes, and household wealth were all lower. And at the same time, unemployment, interest rates, and poverty were all higher. Now, you might say that at least back then, people could buy a home and weren't being forced to finance their burritos thanks to a cost of living crisis, right? Except that, actually, throughout the 1980s, home ownership rates were lower, interest rates were higher, and inflation was even worse. For the people who did buy a home, more than half of the average household income went to mortgage repayments alone, significantly higher than the 33% average today. The households themselves were also significantly smaller and accommodated more people on average. And it's also not like it was all because people were living off a single breadwinner either. By the end of the 1980s, it was actually even less likely to have a stay-at-home partner than it is today. This is to say nothing of the modern conveniences, comforts, and customs that have made our lives a lot more cushy. But despite what the numbers might say, the late 80s and early 90s are often seen as the last time the system was working for the people. It was when the boomers fully entered the workforce and built the foundation that made them the wealthiest generation in history. In fact, even the majority of you guys watching, you know, a group of people who willingly subscribe to look at depressing charts every week, still said you would prefer to live back then. Which raises the question, are we just nostalgic for an economy that never really existed? Or has something else changed that's made all of these macroeconomic numbers comparatively irrelevant?
Ricky Starr is a welder, now laid off for the third time, after earnings of £200 a week.
Inflation report, most major banks raised their prime lending rate to 17.75% for corporate borrowers.
What am I going to do now? Because, like, that put me so far behind in my bills, there was no way I could even try to keep my head above water.
I always grew up thinking about the stereotypical American dream where you own a house and you have a yard to play in, and I think that dream is dying.
So there are really three big, easily measurable areas where the modern day beats out the 1980s, and three slightly more subtle but potentially more important areas where the 1980s win. Each one of these comes with some nuance and challenges to our assumptions that statistically mean you are probably not going to like about 50% of what I have to say for the rest of the video. Between 1980 and 1982, America had one of its worst recessions ever. It was arguably the worst downturn at that point since the Great Depression, and was only really rivaled again in 2008 with the global financial crisis. So, to be fair, when people are talking about the good times in the 1980s, they are talking about the later half of the decade. Likewise, the practical and fiscal reactions to COVID in the early 2020s made every economic metric look like this. To keep the comparison as equal as possible, it makes sense to compare the financial realities faced by someone living in 1985 to the same kind of person living in 2025. The first thing you need to consider is how much weight you put into the data versus the anecdotes. If we were just comparing the economic stats of the 1980s to the 2020s like it was some kind of RPG, then the 2020s are going to win almost every time. This kind of analogy might sound goofy, but it does really help clarify the differences between then and now, so keep it in mind for later. The median real wage is simply 20% higher today than it was back in 1985. Now, you might say, sure, but after inflation and rising inequality, that doesn't mean much, right? Except that median isn't skewed by a few ultra-high-income earners like an average would be. And real earnings means that this is already accounting for inflation. So the middle-of-the-road Americans are 20% better off today than they were 40 years ago. Except that, that doesn't feel right, does it? This is actually one of the biggest challenges we have when assessing if we are moving in the right direction. A major critique of modern economics is that it has developed an almost psychopathic obsession with mathematical modeling to a point where the actual human experience is dismissed as people simply not understanding how good they have it. The point here, though, is that when comparing our progress, achieving good metrics is not necessarily the same as achieving genuinely good outcomes. I could get my Civic to rev higher than a Formula One car by manually shifting it into first gear on the highway. But that doesn't mean I've turned it into a high-performance automobile. Likewise, when a metric like unemployment or real wages becomes a closely measured goal, they cease to become a useful measure because sacrifices get made elsewhere to make them look good at all costs. This vibes versus data is especially hard when assessing the experience of someone living in the 1980s because we generally remember history through rose-tinted glasses. And that is even harder still when statistically, half of you watching weren't even alive back then. An article published in Nature detailed how people overwhelmingly assume that society is in a state of decline, even when the data suggests the opposite. So, on one hand, we need to look beyond the data and consider the tangible human experience. But on the other hand, we need to account for the fact that humans are inherently unreliable. This clusterfuck of contradictions would be comical if only it weren't so genuinely important. This kind of thinking is affecting a lot of big and not particularly good policy decisions today. And that becomes most clear in the categories that the 1980s should win in a landslide: housing, jobs, and who bears the consequences when things go wrong. So it's time to learn how money works to find out if the boomers really did have it easier back in their day, or if there is something else we are missing. This week's video is sponsored by Vanta. Customer trust becomes more and more important as your business grows. And with regulations evolving faster than ever, driven by new technologies, emerging threats, and global market demands, staying compliant is increasingly complex and time-consuming for organizations. That is where Vanta comes in. Vanta is the leading agentic trust platform, and more than 12,000 companies from fast-moving startups to large enterprises rely on it to build and prove trust in a way that is real-time and transparent. As your business scales, the tools you depend on can turn into a maze of separate systems, and that kind of chaos does not support real security. Vanta works like an always-on security expert that grows right along with you. Vanta automates compliance for standards like SOC 2 and ISO 27001, keeps an eye on your controls around the clock, and gives you one clear place to manage compliance and risk. It fits naturally into existing workflows so you can stay focused on running a company your customers feel confident trusting. Get a special offer of $1,000 off Vanta by using the QR code on screen or clicking the link in the description. Okay. So potentially, the defining issue of today's youth is that nobody can afford to buy a home, and this should clearly be a win for the 1980s. One of the most common arguments you have probably heard is that sure, adults entering the workforce back then may not have had 55-inch TVs that cost less than an Uber Eats delivery, or Uber Eats deliveries, or smartphones, but they had one thing that was more important than all of that combined. They could buy a home of their own, right? Well, the only problem is that the home ownership rate in the 1980s was actually lower than it is today. It wasn't actually until the mid-1990s that people started owning their homes at a higher rate than today. And as a little hint, that last spike peaked right before the subprime mortgage crisis. So then, what is actually happening here? Homes in 1985 were undeniably cheaper than homes today, but the gap isn't as huge as you might expect. According to data from the Fed, the average house price to median family income was around 3.08 times in 1985. This means it would take 3 years and 1 month of income to pay for the average family home. Today, according to the same data sets, it's just under 4 times. So yes, prices have risen relative to household incomes, but it's not radically different. This is also far from the whole story. The boomers will be quick to point out that they paid far higher interest rates in this period as well. And you know what? They kind of have a point. Even though their homes were cheaper, if you were to take out an average loan for the median house on a median income in 1985, you would be paying roughly 31% of your income in repayments. Today, that number would be around 24% based on the same assumptions. It's also not like the financialization of houses is a new thing today either. Even back then, most people were told the same general message about their family home being the bedrock of their financial lives. So what actually has changed are the barriers to entry. Family homes were an asset, but they were a store of value asset, rather than a speculative asset that would double in value every 10 years. For the latter half of the 20th century, the Case-Shiller Home Price Index roughly tracked the Consumer Price Index, which in plain English just meant that home prices stayed in line with inflation. For a lot of people who had just lived through some of the worst inflation in the country's history, this was still a very desirable quality. It was a hard asset that you could put money into that would retain its value over time. Now, you might be thinking that people could have just invested in the stock market, but at this time, participation in investment markets like this was far lower than it is today, for reasons that we will get into soon. As far as housing goes, though, the fact that it just kept up with inflation meant that for a lot of buyers, there wasn't the same urgency to get into a house or else. If it took you 10 years to save for a house, the relative price would still be much the same, and the higher interest rates would actually help you with that saving. Today, by comparison, a lot of first-time home buyers have the anxiety that if they can't buy a house as soon as possible, prices will rise faster than inflation in their incomes, and they may eventually be permanently priced out of their area. Even though home ownership rates were technically slightly lower, buying a home wasn't such an existential challenge. I hate to keep bringing it up, but this is where the vibes versus data really matters. With the benefit of hindsight, we know that people who bought houses back here got an asset that appreciated at twice the rate of inflation. Had we all been living back then knowing what we know now, then of course we would have dived into the housing market headfirst. But in doing that, we would have caused the same problems. 2 decades of low interest rates have also clearly distorted this market. The divergence in home prices from underlying inflation really began when we decided that cheap debt would solve all of our problems. Which brings us along to perhaps one of the least obvious things that the 1980s had going for them, which was getting a loan for everything else. It's no secret today that you can finance just about anything. Home loans may have lower interest rates, but car loans, personal loans, credit cards, HELOCs, wage advances, buy now pay later, and reverse mortgages have all been offered up to the consumer in record numbers. Credit cards did exist back in the 1980s, but limits were strict, repayments were closely monitored, and the number of people they were actually given to was a lot more exclusive. The total amount of revolving consumer debt is far higher today than it was back then, and repayments are equally taking up a far higher percentage of household budgets. Even if you don't personally have any debt outside of something like your mortgage, you're still paying the price for this explosion in consumer credit. The reason that something like cars have been able to get so expensive even after accounting for improved features is because it's easier to finance them over longer terms with looser conditions. This has also allowed automakers to fatten up their margins because dealers assume that they will make their profit in the financing of the vehicle, not in the unit margins themselves. This means that if you want to pay all cash for a basic commuter vehicle, it's going to be much harder and more expensive today than it was back in the 1980s. Now, this has hit cars and housing, but the most serious categories require a category of their own. To go back to our little anecdote about role-playing in a video game, the 1980s were kind of like the tutorial levels. Sure, you don't have access to as many outright resources, and you can't use all of the tools in the game yet, but you also can't hurt yourself with those same tools. If you play absolutely perfectly, it is theoretically better to be playing in the endgame. But if you don't know exactly what to do with everything coming at you, then one slip-up will have much greater consequences. And like all fair and balanced video games, sometimes you can play perfectly and still fail. So that brings us on to getting an education and getting sick. College degrees became easier for people to finance and simultaneously harder to discharge through bankruptcy. Just like cars in the last few years, this made tuition far more expensive over time, because there was no real demand constraint from young people who could borrow everything they needed to attend what they were told was their ticket to a middle-class life. Likewise, medical costs have been allowed to massively outpace inflation thanks to bureaucracy, insurance, and financialization. And this data is only from 2000 onwards. Now, both of these topics need a video of their own, but they are ultimately the result of a different change. According to data from the Fed, in 1985, the financial industry represented about 4.5% of total economic activity. Today, it is approaching 8%, which may not seem like a lot, but that means it has almost doubled in relative size at the same time as things like technology have also emerged as major industries. From a top-down perspective, the financial sector does play an important role in the economy by redistributing risk and capital to where it's needed. But the only way that it can double its effective slice of the pie is by ultimately issuing more insurance contracts in debt. Rana Faruhar, a veteran business journalist, published a book on this called Makers and Takers that essentially made the argument that as the financial industry grows too large, as it has done in America and most major economies, it goes from a system that facilitates activity to a clot in the system that just harvests wealth. She has also done a number of really good interviews here on YouTube, so I will leave a link to that in her book in the description below like always. Now, speaking of YouTube, as someone who makes his living doing a job that didn't even exist 20 years ago, the march of technology is clearly in favor of the modern day. But when viewed purely through the lens of our financial lives, it has come with some trade-offs. Being constantly connected has created the expectation that people are always available if something comes up at work. Individually, a lot of technologies are specifically tailored to extract as much value out of you as possible, whether that be in the form of more targeted advertising or just more time doom-scrolling. We can use these technologies in amazing ways, but they are also another dangerous tool that can do a lot of harm if we are not really careful with them. Now, this is all to do with how we spend our money, but perhaps the most nuanced change has come from how we earn it. Median incomes are higher today, but one of the biggest reasons why it doesn't feel like that is because the way we make those incomes has become far less secure and dignified. Job tenure has been noticeably declining since the 1980s. The share of workers with more than 10 years with a single employer has fallen across all age groups. The reason for this is because both companies and workers have fewer forces holding them together. Labor unions were significantly weakened in the 80s, which means employee-employer relationships became more one-on-one and ultimately more a game of who can get the most out of who until a better offer comes along. At the same time, auxiliary benefits like corporate pension programs became significantly less common, with most of the burden of retirement planning offloaded onto either the government or the individual employee themselves through market-based retirement accounts. Again, if you navigate these systems perfectly with strong financial literacy and discipline, then sure, you can build more tangible wealth with modern individual retirement accounts. but the risk is all on you. By the numbers alone, you are statistically better off today. There has never been a time when it's easier to make a lot of money very quickly. But it has also never been easier to be financially smushed by any number of dangerous financial tools that have become commonplace in our economy. Generationally, the boomers didn't necessarily have it any better. But what they did have was the ability to start out in the safe, easy zone to build up a foundation and then retire into the endgame. A lot of people starting out today are doing it the other way around. But go and watch this video next to find out if that will all change when the boomers eventually die. And don't forget to like and subscribe to keep on learning how money works.